Good evening and welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY. I'm John Pierce, co-host this evening with Ray Schwab. Ray is working the board for us. Thank you very much, sir. And another co-host as a kind of a different format this evening, and she is Gloria McVeigh. Gloria, what's our topic tonight?
Hi, John. Thanks for letting me co-host. We have some interesting people on tonight who are going to talk about a subject that's much in the news right now, pending gun violence prevention legislation. There are several pieces of legislation in Congress right now, and we have two interesting folks to talk about that, two local attorneys who are both gun owners, but and also are very interested in the legal arguments behind things like the Second Amendment, which often comes up in this discussion. And I'll just tell you a little bit about them first. We have with us tonight attorney John Vivian. He's been a Pennsylvania attorney since 1981. He's nationally board certified as in civil trial advocate and pretrial civil advocate. He specializes in personal injury litigation. And we also have Brian Monahan, a Pennsylvania attorney since 1982, practices in Easton. And his specialty is criminal law, municipal law, estates and wills. He's a former public defender, actually a chief public defender, and former solicitor to Northampton County Council. So we have some questions that we're going to talk about tonight, and what I'm going to do is ask John and Brian to address each of them. I'll start with you, John. In the wake of the Sandy Hook shooting that made gun violence a national issue, what proposals for increased regulations of guns would you propose?
Thank you, Gloria, and thank you, WDIY, for hosting this. Most of the legislation that has already been proposed makes sense to me. I'm in favor of an assault weapons ban on new weapons, limited clips in terms of capacity. I believe we need complete background checks. We need to close the so-called gun show loophole. I think that we should have a limit of one handgun per month purchase. I also think that something nobody ever talks about is an educational component. As a firearms owner and as someone who's hunted, I've trained my children to use firearms. I know Brian has. I instructed NRA courses in New Jersey briefly. And it has always bothered me that someone will go and purchase a firearm and not have to be trained in or educated to do so. That's kind of important. That doesn't go to these mass shootings as much as it goes to accidental problems in the home. Somebody gets a home for a gun for home defense and shoots their spouse coming home late, or the kids get a hold of it because they're just simply not educated, and that's got to be part of the law also. And I think you've got to eliminate these the instant check from the aspect of, I think there ought to be a 30-day waiting period. Generally, in my view, if somebody needs a gun today or tomorrow, it's usually not a legitimate reason. Thank you.
Thanks, John. Brian, would you like to address that question?
Yeah, I would, and I appreciate the opportunity to appear here today with WDIY and, of course, John Pierce, a normal host, and you, Gloria, for your patience. I've known John for a lot of years, and I think on many issues we agree, and I think to some extent tonight we're going to agree here. I think, though, that there's a basic constitutional argument that the Second Amendment is in the Bill of Rights, that it has a large history, that its history is based on self-protection of individuals, the fear of those that wrote the Constitution of a totalitarian government, and also at the time, and I think maybe even to some extent now, the fear that foreign individuals or nations might come in and cause problems in our society. I think that it is a national issue. I think a lot of the things that are on the table should be thought about carefully. I think there's a social component to this. I think from my practice, especially in the criminal defense area, that I've seen way too many autopsy photographs in murder cases and homicides. I've seen young kids involved in gun violence, and it's very easy to pull a trigger, and you can't take that bullet back. but there is a right to have and bear arms, and it shall not be infringed. I think a lot of the proposals that are on the table now were on the table before, and I think we should be careful before we jump to enact regulations and statutes.
John, I'll ask you the follow-up question then, since Brian raised the issue of the Second Amendment, something that often comes up in these discussions. Do you believe that the current proposed legislation and that you just described would be constitutional?
It's absolutely constitutional. I think Brian and I agree on the basis of the Second Amendment. As he indicated, we have a lot of areas we agree on. All the legislation that is currently proposed is constitutional. All one has to do is read the D.C. Heller case, the case that got all the publicity a couple of years back, which finally established that which Brian and I knew all along, and the right to possess and bear arms is an individual right. It has nothing to do with the Army. The Heller case, written in the majority opinion by Justice Scalia, I would submit a fairly conservative individual, recognizes in its text that the Second Amendment is not absolute. The problem we seem to have with this legislation is that many people take the position the Second Amendment is somehow absolute. There is no amendment that is absolute. The First Amendment is not. The Fourth Amendment is not. None of the amendments are absolute. So the bottom line is here that what are the reasonable restrictions that the court would uphold? What most people don't know about is the second Heller case. Mr. Heller, who was the complainant essentially in the Supreme Court case, was challenging a law in the District of Columbia which said, you know, you can't possess a firearm. By the way, Allentown has a law like that that's still in the books that I got involved with. But he then went back and decided that they revamped their legislation and put limits on clips and limits on assault weapons, and he therefore took an appeal on that. The D.C. Circuit Court said they certainly can regulate those things constitutionally, and right now that's the state of the law because the Supreme Court did decline certification. They declined to hear the case. So that circuit court, as Brian and I both know, is the last word on that for that circuit. In fact, Scalia in the case cites a case called U.S. versus Miller. That was a case that upheld the banning of automatic weapons in the wake of the similar mass murder numbers we showed back in the roaring late 20s and prohibition times. So, yeah, it's constitutional.
Brian, how would you respond to that?
I think I agree in many respects with John. I own a semi-automatic weapon, I think often wrongly described as an assault rifle. I don't think you need a 30-round clip or a 20-round clip. But on the other hand, if you had a 5-round clip and someone was hell-bent on causing damage in any kind of a community setting where they know there's no guns, like a school or a theater, they can reload fairly quickly. Much of the handgun violence in Texas and in other places, I'm trying to think of the name of the fort down in Texas where we had a huge, it was a military base.
Fort Hood?
It was the Fort Hood incident. The damage there was done with handguns. And if someone wants to become proficient with a firearm, if they have some mental health disabilities, most of these folks do, and they want to somehow be published in the media, they're going to learn how to use those firearms. And you can, even with a 12-gauge double-barrel shotgun, if you have skills, you can cause a lot of damage. So to the extent that the regulations are there, I'm not really sure how effective they would be. I think human nature sometimes overcomes regulations. I think every time the government passes a regulation, there's always some way that someone tries to find a loophole or a way around it. And I think there's got to be more focus on the social problems that we have. I was involved in a triple homicide and the lead counsel in Easton, which happened not too long ago. And Ollie Davis had just turned 18, and he also committed another homicide. He came from Irvington, was a great basketball player here in Bethlehem. And to see the family being torn, to see the damage that was done, to see the autopsy photographs, and that wasn't with an assault rifle. That was with something, it was 9mm, and it was a .45 and handguns. So I think there's a social component that needs to be addressed. It's not being, in my view, In Pennsylvania, we have background checks. Every time that I've purchased a firearm, I've had to have a criminal record check, and it's done through a computer. Maybe there needs to be a little bit more to the background evaluation, but how much more, I'm not sure at this point could occur.
Yeah, the problem with that is, Brian, that I've been involved in cases also. If you remember the tragic bank murders that occurred with Martin Apple and Stanley Herzog, Martin Apple filled out an application where he checked that he had been convicted of a crime, and you know, we deposed the person who sold that weapon at a place in Allentown.
And by the way, I represented Marty Apple in a post-conviction proceeding.
I remember. And what he did is he crossed out the yes and checked no. The guy said initially, he came back 3 days later. Back then it was a 3-day waiting period.
Right.
And got his weapon and went out and shot. The other problem is that Pennsylvania, like anywhere else, I've never purchased a weapon in Pennsylvania where I haven't survived a background check, and nor can you be licensed to carry weapons without surviving a pretty significant background check by our sheriff. Pennsylvania has the same problem. So if we turn away somebody at the point of purchase at, say, Dick's Sporting Goods over on off of Route 33, he waits till Sunday, goes to a gun show at Ag Hall or Harrisburg, and he can buy whatever he wants without a background check. That's deeply disturbing to me, and it's also deeply disturbing to most Americans as well as NRA members. Over last poll I saw, about 84% of NRA individual members believe there should be a complete background check. And over 90% of Americans believe that. And the problem is right now in Congress, nobody seems to want to move on it. So while you regard it as a national issue, I actually regard it as a state issue. I'm seeing a gun-favorable state like Colorado pass a very effective firearms regulation. Connecticut is bound to do that. They had one before. I also think that if you want to see a great model for a state law that seems to me to be reasonable, take a look at the California law. You can look it up on the web. It's a great law.
So to get back to the discussion about the Second Amendment, because that does come up so often, how does that play out with the issue about background checks? What do you see as the major pros and cons in passing that legislation to require universal background checks for purchases of guns?
It's already been in the law. I think the important thing about background checks, and many of my colleagues disagree with me, you know, Brian mentioned social things and that sort of thing. I agree that needs to be looked at. My problem with one faction in this argument is they want to talk about everything except guns. I'm one of the people who believes that if you survive a background check, that you should have to either voluntarily or be able to be subject to them looking at your mental health records. Now, it's a lot. It took a lot for me to get there. I'm a very strong believer in First Amendment privacy rights. We have HIPAA laws for a reason. We have that kind of privacy for a reason. But, you know, when I have an individual who's an innocent victim in an accident case, truck driver runs them over, they die, they suffer serious injuries. By virtue of the fact that we file for emotional pain and suffering in a civil case, the defense is allowed almost unfettered right to look into that person's mental background and their mental health records. Now, that's an innocent victim who's trying to be compensated through our legal system. This is someone who wants to go out and buy a deadly weapon, and we're saying you can't look into their mental health backgrounds. I think that's wrong. I think you have a choice, and I think you need to be trained. I made that point before. You know, you can't drive an automobile without having a test and showing proficiency. And I think if you're going to be a gun owner, you need to be responsible. And it's one thing to say you're responsible. It's another thing to take the steps to be responsible. And unfortunately, sometimes the government has to get involved in doing that.
Brian, I'd like your opinion on that also.
I guess my biggest fear, and I, at age 57, I'm starting to get a little gray hair gain some pounds, but I've seen a lot, and I remember when I was a younger man, my father, who was 92, going to be 93 on May 21, he always used to talk about a man's home as his castle. He always talked about cash on the barrelhead, and I remember there was a time when no one would give out their Social Security number as an identification resource, if you will. And I think times are changing, and I think the government is growing, and I think there have been advances in technology almost to the point where we do have an Orwellian society. And I don't want to sound like an extremist or something, but that book, 1984, is here. And to the extent that we provide information or registration information of guns, it scares me. It scares me because in a totalitarian society, that's the first place they go. They try to disarm the public. Now, John and I have talked about this, and I think John believes that there are so many guns out there that it would be difficult for that to happen here. But, you know, in England, they didn't have guns. And during World War II, there was a call to arms, and Americans were sending shotguns and all kinds of firearms over there because they didn't have the arms to arm themselves. That could happen here, and it scares me. In terms of the mental health issue, I think to the extent that there are markers, probably now with the Affordable Care Act, the government probably is going to have that information anyway. So that's a 1984 issue, but I think it's something that needs to be examined. And I don't want someone with an extreme mental disability, and I've seen those people. Unfortunately, I've represented them successfully at times. But if someone has that kind of issue, they shouldn't really be around firearms. And that's my thought.
Yeah, my thought on registration is pretty simple. I think if you're going to possess a semi-automatic assault rifle, and this argument always revolves around how one defines an assault weapon, one reason that the anti-gun lobby is rebuked is that they say, well, these measures didn't work in the past. And part of that is because you frankly have legislators who are writing legislation and don't know anything about firearms. In the wake of Sandy Hook, as we were watching the news unfold, I said to my wife, it's an illegal weapon. There's an assault weapons ban in Connecticut. There were five or six states, and I knew Connecticut was one of them, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and some others. Then I investigated it, and you know, if that weapon had a bayonet port on it, it would have been a prohibited weapon. But since it did not have a bayonet port, it was not under their law. Now, to me, that seems irrational and insane. Nobody's going to use that weapon to go stab school kids. So I think that what you have to look at with an assault weapon is this, not what it looks like. You and I both know an assault weapon is defined as something designed to kill a human being. Under that definition, because animals can't be assaulted legally, okay, I own five or six assault weapons. They're handguns. The traditional .45 that everybody knows from the Army, I have two of them, and they're an assault weapon. They're not designed to do anything except shoot a human being. Now, with respect to the long assault weapons with this kind of capacity, I've got to say California's got the right idea. They should be registered. They should have ATT permits, authority to transport if you're going to take them off your property. I'm willing to recognize someone's Second Amendment right to own and possess that weapon. I think they need to recognize the right of what is now a majority of America that does not want them off their property. Okay? So if you're going to take it off your property under, for instance, the California law, you need an authority transport permit that allows you to go to the range and back, allows you to take it to gunsmith. It's going to be worked on Gustator with it. All these things ensure that weapon will not get into illegal hands, which seems to be that stance which the NRA is always taking. Closing loopholes, all these things are designed to keep weapons out of the hands of criminals, and I think you and I agree we don't want them to have them.
I do agree, but I, from my experience, John, criminals get guns. I've represented felons that have had straw purchasers buy firearms. Again, generally, they're handguns. Unfortunately, the prosecution of those persons does not happen all that often, and I think this, in our county, I know it does. But generally, it's drug-related incidents. Generally, there's a warrant issued for a home, and they find drugs, and then they find the felon who has the, you know, the 45 or the 9 millimeter, or the, you know, the Glock 40. Brian, so I really believe that the idea. We'll talk about this in a few.
Brian, when you say our county, you mean Northampton?
Yes,
Northampton County. And John, practicing also in Northampton.
Also, east in Northampton County, our offices are probably 200 yards apart, maybe not even.
I don't want to give any plugs to any politicians, and I won't, but we do have a district attorney in Northampton County, and he is
very good.
Not running for office, and he's very good.
You are listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY. We are talking about gun control, assault weapons, and such, which is, could I say, a smoking hot topic these days, Gloria? I'm John Pierce. Joined this evening, Ray Schwab, doing our work on the board, along with Gloria McVeigh, co-hosting with me. And we're speaking with attorneys John Vivian and Brian Monahan. We need to take a break right now. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
For program support on WDIY, we thank the Sands Bethlehem Event Center, presenting a performance by Willie Nelson and family, touring in support of his new album, Heroes, and performing new material, as well as all the hits that made him famous. Sunday, June 16th at the Sands Bethlehem Event Center. Tickets and information on this and other shows at sandseventcenter.com.
For program support on WDIY, we thank Touchstone Theater on Bethlehem Southside in their 32nd season, presenting Ulysses Dreams, an exploration of origin and destiny, performed by the Touchstone Ensemble. This modern adaptation of the adventures of the hero Ulysses is performed in the form of a song cycle dealing with the characters of Ulysses and his relationship with various women in his life. April 13th to the 21st. For tickets or information, 610-867-1689 or touchstone.org.
We're back now on Lehigh Valley Discourse. Gloria McVeigh.
Thanks, John. I want to get back to the topic which is on everyone's mind, which is the mass shootings that they just bring everybody to a halt, and certainly the one that happened in Sandy Hook last December just put this issue on front of mind for so many of us. And I'm wondering, in terms of mass shootings, when I listen to the news, I hear a lot of statistics, and sometimes they seem to contradict each other. John, how do you think a listener who's trying to decide what they believe on these issues, how should they think about the statistics that they hear?
I always laugh because one of my favorite authors was Mark Twain or Samuel Clemens, and he popularized the line, you know, lies, damned lies, and statistics. A lot of statistics I hear are not really relevant if one's going to talk about mass shootings. Mass shootings are a specific genre of crime as classified by the FBI. There's a great article in Mother Jones that ran about that, which cites the FBI statistics as well as the Justice Department statistics. In those crimes, the ones we're talking about here, which are mass shootings like at Newtown, theater shooting like Aurora, getting to Gabby Gifford incident, those do not include any kind of crimes, and people should understand this in terms of gang violence or a spree shooter such as the guy who was shooting from his trunk down in the D.C., Virginia area. These are just mass shooting crimes. And in all those crimes over 3 decades, the statistics are something like 142 to 149 weapons were used, and most of them had multiple weapons. 25% of those weapons were semi-automatic assault rifles, AK platforms, AR-15 platforms, the Bushmaster you've heard about, which is an AR-15 platform, HK platforms, and Uzi-type platforms. In addition to that, they've always selected handguns. So truly, there were only 39 weapons that were revolvers and shotguns. Everything else was primarily a semi-automatic handgun. The problem is no one's broken down those statistics as to how many of them had extended clips. If you look at the Gabby Gifford case, for instance, this guy had a 33-shot clip. I think he had 28 rounds in it because they get hard to load at one point, you know. And it was when he exhausted his clip that a 70-year-old person took him down, and he was trying to reload, and that's when they caught him. Now, if we had a reasonable restriction on clip limitation like we had under the lapsed ban, it's unarguable. There only been 9 shots fired, so you would have had, you know, a dozen less rounds or more. It would have went out. And, you know, you're never going to solve all the violence, but what you are going to do in those circumstances, I believe, is save lives. Now, in Aurora, the guy had a 100-shot drum, and it jammed. So the number of people he killed and the 58 people he wounded, whatever those statistics are, would have been a heck of a lot worse. I think it jammed around 30 shots. He did the rest of the damage with handguns, and I believe they had extended clips or high-capacity clips. My belief is you don't need more than 9-10 shots. If somebody breaks into your house and you can't defend yourself with 9 shots from a .45, I suggest 3 things. Number one, you practice the fine art of marksmanship. Number two, get somebody else to do your shooting. And number three, you probably ought to get rid of the gun.
Hmm. Brian, what do you think about
this? I spoke to this before. I think that, in my view, if someone becomes proficient with a firearm and you have a clip limitation, you can change that clip out in half a second. And if you're trained, it's not going to matter. I mean, the fact that the drum jammed is a blessing. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, you know, if he had 9-round clips and just kept going through them and no one was there to oppose him and he knew it was a gun-free zone, if you will, and schools are like that. These guys don't pick targets where, you know, you have a German Shepherd in your house barking at night, or they don't pick targets where they know there's going to be security officers. It doesn't happen that way, and they're preying on the weak. That's what's going on here, in my view.
Well, I don't know. Columbine had armed guards. Virginia Tech had armed guards. Gabby Gifford was surrounded by state and local law armed officials. And while it wasn't a mass shooting when Reagan and Brady got shot, they were surrounded supposedly by the best bodyguards in the world, that being the Secret Service. So, this brings up the question where I think Gloria is going to go, and that is, you know, I read Hutchinson's report the other night about increasing arms in schools and teaching teachers to shoot, and I think it's just a really, really bad idea. If you look at the Times Square incident that just happened, this individual walked up, shot somebody in the back of the head, two trained NYPD police officers, and they take their marksmanship seriously. They're one of the better trained forces out there. They shot a total of 16 shots, didn't hit the guy once. He wound up shooting himself, and he wounded, six other people or nine? I think it was six. So these are trained law enforcement officials who practice every day, go to ranges, have to make qualifications. So if you're telling me you can take the average armed school guard in the Eastern District and tack 40 more to 50 more hours on, like the Hutchinson report commissioned by the NRA says, and you're not going to have innocent bystanders shot, I just think it's a very bad idea to arm teachers. Plus, kids can overpower them and take the gun away. You know, they're not law enforcement officers, they're teachers.
As a quick follow-up, thanks, Gloria. But more to my point, a determined criminal, whether it's the police there, the Secret Service, or an armed school guard, is going to accomplish his purpose. And that's what I see in what I do. I've represented people in home invasions. Judge Moran sentenced, he's a retired senior judge. He had his way with sentencing after we lost. But the reality is they're determined. And whatever the crime is, so why punish those that are law-abiding, want to shoot targets, want to go to the range and such, and want, more importantly, the firearm in the home for defense, whether it's defense of criminals or whether it's defense of a totalitarian government.
Yeah, I agree with you, Brian. I mean, as you know, I believe strongly in the right to protect my home and to protect my person. There are times as lawyers when we're in neighborhoods that aren't good neighborhoods. West Reading comes to mind, Allentown. I know you've been there. And I believe strongly you have a right to carry an arm and protect yourself at that time. I think where we differ is that a person like an Adam Lanza, you know, there are mothers now against gun violence. And they published a whole series of facts, which I found fascinating because they're not glossed over. They're actual facts. One of the facts, which I was unaware of because they've just released a lot of the things from the Sandy Hook or Newtown shooting, was that when he stopped to change the clip, 11 children fled to safety just in that instant when he was changing the clip. Now, you know, it's undeniable that in the Gabby Gifford case, in that case, and in Virginia Tech, had there been less than multiple clips used, these kind of clips we're trying to ban, that lives would have been saved. And while I realize you can't make it perfect, I think we have an obligation as a society to try to save lives. And not just protect the schools, because the NRA's proposal doesn't talk about that school shootings and these mass shootings are 25% roughly of all the shootings. More take place at the place of employment or in and around there. The rest of them are split between theaters, parking lots, restaurants, and in and around government buildings. So the proposal, while it will protect our children, okay, if it's viable, and I don't think it is, doesn't protect the child who leaves the school, a 6-year-old and a 9-year-old, one of whom went to an Aurora Theater and wound up dead, and one of whom went to see her representative, Gabby Gifford, and wound up dead. So you're not doing anything to protect that. And my suggestion is you need to get a clamp on these weapons, because they say they don't work. I can tell you this, there were roughly 1 million of these assault rifles in the United States when the ban was allowed to elapse by Congress. There are now over 3 million at the time Biden started doing his investigation. And judging by the gun shops I go to, there's no ammo, there's no clips, there's nothing. So they bought them out like hotcakes. I wouldn't be surprised if there's 3.5 million of them now. And you've got to stop it somewhere, you know, because a kid like Lanza gets his hand on it, and what you have is Newtown.
So one of the pieces of legislation that's under discussion right now would ban assault weapons. And the legislation that California Senator Dianne Feinstein developed identifies over 2,000 weapons as assault guns that would be banned. I'm wondering, I'd like to hear from each of you how you think you'd like to see that legislation go. Brian, you first.
I take a different view than John on this. I don't think the legislation should go anywhere. And I believe, again, we should focus more on the mental health and social issues to resolve the problem. That's my belief, and it's a more conservative belief. I think a criminal is going to commit a crime no matter what. And I think, again, if there's a loophole in a law, someone's going to find it.
I think the legislation ought to be passed. I supported the former legislation under Clinton's omnibus bill. I think without it, you're facing another Newtown down the road, another Virginia Tech, another Aurora, another Gabby Gifford. If you can at least minimize the damage that's allowed to be inflicted, you can save lives. And I think there's an obligation to save lives. And I think the reason it's not going to go anywhere, unfortunately, is because of the NRA, which, by the way, many members of my family still belong. My father and my grandfather were proud members. They were a good organization. They were co-sponsors of the first major firearms bill, the 1968 Federal Firearms Act. They used to be in favor of background checks. And who I haven't heard from in this entire debate are any of the gun manufacturers. And the reason I don't need to hear from them is because the NRA speaks for them. When they speak out against background checks, when 84% of their own members are for it, I don't understand that kind of representation. And we've almost accepted in America, have we not, that, well, you can forgive this guy for not voting for this because he'll get primaried out. So now it's become a politician can raise their hand and take an oath to do their best for the people. And what essentially happens is it's now acceptable to preserve your political career over that of protecting school kids like at Newtown. And personally, I never thought we'd get to that place in this country, Brian. It sickens me.
And on the subject of clips, John, as you brought up, there was a recent report released about the investigation into the Sandy Hook shooting, and one statistic was that shooter fired off 152 rounds in 5 minutes. If he'd been limited by the 10 bullet limit that is also another piece of legislation under discussion, he would have had to reload 14 times. And the argument there is that would have been 14 opportunities for people to tackle him, take him down sometime, some way. What are your positions on the 10-bullet limit on magazines and clips?
I discussed this previously, Gloria, and I just don't believe it would be effective.
Is there a number that you'd be comfortable with, if not 10?
I don't see why anyone needs 150-round magazine. And again, the one I have is 20. And I don't, you know, John talked about how hard they are to load. It's hard to load an 8 or 9 round magazine. They're very difficult, especially in .45. But the reality is, from my point of view, is that the lawful gun owner who has a purpose for that should be allowed to have at least something beyond, you know, 20 rounds. John believes in registration. I don't. I'm not so sure that the hypothetical that every time you reload gives someone time to get away. I've seen too many sportsman shows where people who practice are able to reload a magazine very quickly. Police officers do that in their training. And I think to the extent you want to put a ban on the number of rounds, really it will be ineffective.
Do you think it would be an imposition on responsible gun owners to put a limit on the number of rounds? Do you see that as a burden? Do you see that's something that most gun owners would object to?
I'm not sure, Gloria, what most gun owners would do. I can only give you my personal feelings, and I don't have any position there or that way.
So your objection is primarily that it would be ineffective in stopping these mass shootings?
Correct.
Okay, John?
Well, I have a 9mm handgun. It used to belong to my investigator, Bud Bateman. I transferred it through Elmo Fry up in Nazareth. If you want to legally transfer a weapon, I suggest you do that. It's the last gun I'd reach for in home defense. The 9mm is just simply somebody has a vest on, forget it. Somebody's hopped up on PCP or whatever, forget it. 45 is my choice, and they are hard to load. I don't have any problem with my one has a 7-shot clip in it, and I feel that's perfectly adequate. The problem with large capacity magazines is exactly that. Now, we'll never know unless we go back to that, because you're absolutely right about Newtown. The issue of armed guards. From all reports, official reports, this guy shot himself into this school with a 223 Bushmaster. Okay, I would suggest to you any guard running down that hall was going to get killed. Okay, as far as the clips, you know, we'll never know whether or not that principal could have tackled him when he was reloaded, or that guidance counselor may not have lost his life, or how many other groups of 11 kids could have escaped while he was reloading. We'll never know. And the point is, I'm like you, a realist, Brian, and I agree with you. Somebody who's bound and determined to commit a murder is probably going to do that. The question is, in these mass shootings, can we somehow limit the just extraordinary damage that is done? And I think that the clip capacity limitation has to do with that.
Another proposal that John mentioned previously was a 30-day waiting period for purchase of a handgun or semi-automatic assault rifle. Brian, would you like to respond as to whether you think that would be effective, not effective, whether you think there should be any waiting period at all?
I'm not sure that a waiting period is going to prevent a mass shooting. It may prevent a domestic violence shooting or something of that nature, family dispute. I have no issue with a waiting period, and I really don't. 30 days may be long, but to just drop in and purchase the firearm, to me, is an issue. I've purchased firearms through the internet, and there are several websites where you can do that, and the firearm is shipped to a federally licensed firearms dealer. Mark Spaziani in Easton is the one that I use. Elmo, don't get mad at me. He's up in Nazareth. He's a former magistrate. He's actually up in Wind Gap now. But it takes time to purchase something, to have it shipped, to meet with, you know, Mark to take care of the transaction. I think the last firearm I bought, it was in his office for 30 days. I had no hurry to run out and you know, get it. So to the extent that it cools someone off from a domestic dispute or some other dispute, I have no issue with it.
A question, Gloria. What is the waiting period in Pennsylvania now if you're going to buy a firearm?
My understanding is I haven't bought a firearm from a licensed dealer since 1986. It was a 357 Magnum in Easton. The rest of them were all transferred from a former investigator and an Iwo Jima survivor named Bud Bateman. My understanding is right now that it's InstaCheck in Pennsylvania. InstaCheck means you go in, you fill out your application, they run it, you go get a hamburger, you come back, you walk out with a weapon. So unlike Brian, who purchases what he needs on the internet and does it legally through a federal firearms dealer, you can go into Dick's Sporting Goods before Newtown, and my understanding is my cousin bought one that way. You fill out your papers. They went down the road, I think had lunch at Friday's, went back, took an AR-15 out the door with, I think, a couple hundred rounds.
And we're back on Lehigh Valley Discourse, talking this evening about gun control, and my co-host, Gloria McFay.
Thanks, John. Brian, you mentioned something interesting just before the break, which was that you have experience ordering guns online, and I know that people can also order ammunition online. Do you know anything about how that happens? Does it get delivered right to your house? You mentioned you had to go to a gun store to pick up the weapon you ordered. Would you have to also pick up ammunition that you ordered?
Well, let me just explain that briefly. When you purchase a firearm, there's several websites that individuals and gun shops utilize on the internet to sell guns. You can buy books online. You can't do it on Amazon.com, but you can buy guns, and there's websites that do that. And federal law requires that the guns be shipped to a federally licensed firearms dealer. So that licensed firearms dealer takes care of the transaction in Pennsylvania, make sure that there's a background check so that you know, they do the criminal record check that they would do at a store like Dick's or Cabela's or anything like that. Ammunition is not regulated. I will tell you that there are many websites that you can purchase ammunition online, just like you could go into Dick's or Cabela's and purchase ammunition. But that ammunition is currently unavailable. I actually been on one website. They sponsored a sporting goods show, Midway USA, and it's all sold out. I have theories on that, but that's a long way off from this particular show. So, John, I don't know if you have any comments.
Yeah, I do. Connecticut, as a matter of fact, I think I heard from you, John, today that the governor signed their bill. And my understanding was one of the things he was talking about last night on one of the news shows was that it is one of the first times that I know of where you're actually going to have a background check done now when you buy ammunition in Connecticut. And I haven't really thought out whether I'm in favor of that or not in favor of that, but I suppose I probably will be in favor of that because I envision a situation where someone who's been a law-abiding citizen who has weaponry now gets convicted of some offense whereby he was not supposed to have those types of weapons. He's now planning something like an Aurora. He can go out and he can buy 1,000 rounds of 7.65s or 223s to help him facilitate that crime. So it would seem to me if you're going to have a background check for the weapon, it makes no sense to have one, and it's fairly ineffective if you don't have a background check to purchase ammunition, particularly in large quantities. I'd say if somebody wants to buy a box of shotgun shells or one box of 223s, but somebody wants to buy ammo during, let's say, a month cycle that constitutes 1,000 rounds, I think somebody needs to inquire as to why that's so, and I think law enforcement will know about it also.
I would just offer this in response, and again, I'm not one of these "the sky is falling" person, and you know, I have a couple cans of soup in the house, and if things ever hit the fan, I'd probably be in trouble. But I believe that sometimes there is a domino effect to things, and you know, I always believe that there would be a tax on the ammunition, and as time goes on, there wouldn't be any ammunition, and right now, if you want ammunition, you can't get it. I don't know if you've been to Cabela's lately, John, but there's none there. There's none on the internet side. I mean,
one of those strange guys. So I only go buy ammunition when I need it to hunt or whatever else.
Right.
I have quite a number of rounds that I own. But on that issue, I think it's kind of interesting. I don't believe in the slippery slope argument, you know, the sky is falling kind of argument. I think most Americans would agree with most of what we're saying, and we're in the middle. I think the problem is you have extremes on the far left and on the far right that are unrealistic. You know, believing that anytime you take a gun away from someone, that's an absolute Second Amendment violation. We both know that's not true. And I think what our aim should be as a society is to try to at least minimize the impact of these weapons that are around. You know, we have the largest gun violence rate of anybody in the civilized world, and there's got to be a reason for it. It should stop.
Another area that's being discussed as possible action by Congress is gun trafficking. There are different laws at the state level to prevent this kind of thing, but advocates would like to see gun trafficking made a federal crime with much more stringent enforcement and punishment. What's your position on that, John?
I think we're probably both going to agree. I think it should be very stringent punishment for trafficking in guns. I think one of the problems is that, you know, the right claims that the ATF is ineffective, but yet they haven't allowed the appointment of someone to run it, nor have they funded it. So you can complain about them not doing their job, but if you won't give them the money to do their job and staff them properly, that's pretty hard to do. Those are the kind of issues that I believe both sides ought to be able to come together on. To protect the American people, and unfortunately right now it's more about opposing each other than it is about getting any kind of a reasonable compromise, and that's got to stop.
John,
can one of you just explain what gun trafficking is? Thanks.
John, you can do that.
Sure. Gun trafficking is buying guns and selling them without any legal process. So it could be a person, when one of the things I mentioned at the beginning of the show is to a one-hand gun a purchase month. Regulation which has been proposed. You can go into a gun shop currently, and if you have $40,000, buy $40,000 worth of guns and take them out the door and there's no restriction on you giving those to somebody. Maybe you're a straw purchaser, as Brian talked about, and what that means is that you're not really the person who's going to possess that gun. You're going to buy it and give it to a gang member. You're going to buy a number of guns and sell them at a premium on the street. And you've got to stop that from occurring, because that's another way that legal weapons get into illegal hands. Gun trafficking is technically, on a federal level, taking weapons across state lines. Now, many of the governors I've heard speak on the issues of gun violence, including Chris Christie, the governor of Colorado, the governor of Connecticut, and it came out in the Senate hearings, if anybody bothered to watch them, is that all this gun violence that occurs in Minnesota, these guns are coming from other states. The gun violence that occurs in New Jersey, which has very strict gun laws, and in Connecticut, many times these guns are brought into the state. They're being purchased in some of the southern states or other places and brought into the state. And those legislatures are all looking at legislation now, which is going to punish heavily that kind of conduct. But, you know, you have some states that aren't going to pass it. So for the benefit of, and that's where the federal government comes in, for the benefit of the society as a whole, you're going to need stronger laws in that area. Now, some of the executive orders that President Obama signed, my understanding is two of those go to that issue. How effective they're going to be without congressional legislation, I don't think they're going to be that effective, so I would agree with Brian if he says that.
I would just say this. I think it is an issue of funding, John, and it also is an issue of political will in terms of enforcement. Mm-hmm. There is a Racketeering Influence and Corrupt Organizations Act, or RICO, that is on the books, and I think to the extent that there are corrupt organizations, whether they be cartels or other such organizations, that I believe there is prosecutorial power at this point. But again, there needs to be injustice, a political will to do that. There needs to be funding for agents, and I'm not sure, I'm not an expert, I'm not in law enforcement. I took the other side for too many years, but I'm not sure what funding is available at this point to do that.
Yeah, the problem with RICO is that it doesn't apply to the typical straw purchase, because you need, as you know, you're a criminal lawyer, I'm not, you need a criminal enterprise. And when you only have one individual, RICO doesn't really apply. Now, RICO would, and you're right, they should be using that where you have an individual who is acting in concert with a gang, for instance, to do this kind of gun trafficking or purchase for the gang. But you need specific legislation, I think, targeted at gun trafficking. Nobody's really talking about that right now. There is one or two of the executive orders that touch on that.
John, what is RICO?
RICO is a statute called the Racketeering Influence Corruption
Corrupt Organization
Act. It was an act that was originally passed and targeted, I think, to attack organized crime. It's a federal statute. It has both a criminal and a civil component to it. You have to use some sort of across state lines transaction, be it phones, internet, faxes, etc., as part of that criminal scheme. It takes two separate entities acting in concert. And they've used it against a number of people. When you see an organized crime prosecution, it's usually RICO. Bank frauds, even something like Bernie Madoff did would clearly fall under the RICO Act. So that's what it is.
Another provision, John, that you mentioned briefly was limiting an individual to only purchasing one handgun per month. Is there any limit now on how many you can purchase per month?
Not to my knowledge.
I'd agree. I don't think there is.
And why do you think that that's a good idea?
Well, I think it's a good idea because it does stop the straw purchase for large numbers of handguns for illicit organizations and or criminals. The other thing that it does, and Brian touched on this, he's absolutely right. You know, I don't do domestic cases. I haven't done them in a while, but I used to. Brian's done some, probably still does. When people are in that divorce situation and are really kind of, you know, if there's a protection from abuse issued, it's very common for a judge to sign an order and to instruct the sheriff to go out and take the guy's handguns into possession and his guns and his weapons, because we realize those people are in a bad place. A 30-day waiting period for somebody who doesn't have a gun and is contemplating something like that, which he may never do again in his life, would seem to provide a cooling-off period. that would be true also where anger overtakes someone or someone struggling with substances and or experiencing paranoia and other things before they're treated. But my personal opinion is if you need a gun today or tomorrow, it's usually not for a good purpose. I've had people make an argument in my own family, what if I want to hunt? Now, come on. You know, before you hunt, you have to take a hunter safety course and pass it. You generally know when deer season is. You generally know when small game, turkey's coming up. You know, you have plenty of time to do that. And if you're the kind of hunter that's going to try to go out the day before and equip yourself, go in the field, I don't want to be hunting in the same field with you.
Agreed. I'd say one other thing, though. There are collectors, there are auctions, there are individuals that trade in firearms, and to the extent they don't have federal licensure, that would hurt their ability to collect firearms. So just throw that in there.
Yep. We've been talking about pieces of legislation that are proposed at the federal level and that Congress will be discussing shortly. I'd like to just kind of throw in an idea that I just learned about that is a state-level issue, and that is a state representative who proposes that Pennsylvania could pass a law that makes any law that Congress decides to pass on this issue invalid in the state of Pennsylvania. Have either of you read anything about this? I think it's Metcalf from one of the upper tier states.
All I can say, Gloria, is I laughed at the same time Mr. Monahan laughed. There are states in the wake of the last election who passed laws saying you can't make anybody buy health care. There are people who passed laws saying we're not adhering to this federal law or that federal law. That process is called nullification, broadly under the law. The issue of nullification was decided, I would suggest to you, in the Civil War and in the 60s. Good luck passing any law that is going to nullify a federal law. We see it the other way around. We passed a law in Pennsylvania that said, for instance, in an automobile accident, your private carrier has no subrogation rights. So what every private carrier did is they now have policies under a thing called ERISA, the Employment Retirement Income Security Act, which was designed to stop racketeers from dipping into pension funds. The people who had those types of policies took that case to the Supreme Court, and in a case called FMC versus Holiday Corp, the federal court made it quite clear what the law is, and that is that your law conflicts with the federal law is supreme, and it's therefore going to be enforced. You cannot, on a state level, invalidate federal laws, to my knowledge. How about you, Brian?
No, I agree. It's called preemption. Right. If Congress decides to act and the president signs a law that preempts state law, it's a 10th Amendment issue. To the extent the state does not act and federal government does, federal law prevails. I don't know where that theory came from that somehow a state could pass a law that would somehow supersede the federal government. In fact, I think today, from my view, the federal government is so large, I don't think that's ever going to happen again.
So if Harrisburg were to pass a law like that, it would automatically be overturned in the first court that it was appealed to?
Now, if Harrisburg passes a law and there's been no action by the federal government, then it's a law. But if the federal government passes a law and Harrisburg passes a law to the contrary, the federal law preempts the state law.
Well, if they pass a law that says we're not going to honor any federally passed firearms legislation, it will never survive any kind of a challenge, number one. And number two, I think Brian would agree, I would not like our legislature to be a laughingstock in America, so I would hope they would not do that.
What do you think is the motivation behind proposing a piece of legislation that that seems to be destined for being overturned?
I think this whole issue has become politicized. And I think to the extent that there are states' rights individuals and conservatives that don't like the federal government telling someone what kind of light bulb they can use, and I don't, I think it shows some resistance to an overbroad federal central government.
I think it also sometimes, with respect to politicians, plays to their base. I don't think it has to do with any reasoned or well-reasoned understanding of legislation. I certainly don't believe that someone should be a representative and not understand the Constitution in Pennsylvania or in the state. I remember a number of years ago, and you'll remember, after they passed medical malpractice reform, and our Supreme Court rightfully in Pennsylvania struck down a number of parts of that act as unconstitutional, there were a number of people running around Harrisburg threatening to impeach the Pennsylvania Supreme Court justices, which is singularly amusing to me because there is no provision for impeachment. Pennsylvania uses a judicial conduct review board established in the Constitution. So my immediate response was that I would like it if my legislatures actually had read the Constitution.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think there are too many statesmen in politics these days. Mm-hmm. I think those days have waned.
For our listeners, I'd like to recommend two resources in case they feel they want to take action on this issue. Both have a very strong local involvement. One, I think John actually referred to, it's called Moms Demand Action, and they're available on Facebook. That's Moms Demand Action. The other group is Mayors Against Illegal Guns, and several of our local mayors are members of that organization. Their website is demandaction.org, one word, demandaction.org. And we go ahead, John.
Gloria, I just want to thank you very much. We've come to the end of our hour. You see, Brian, how quickly it went? When you have a couple of guests who are passionate about the subject, and the subject this evening of gun control, and Gloria, wonderful job of co-hosting with me. I appreciate your coming in. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Happy days. You've been listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse. Ray Schwab on the board and John Pierce with you today with Gloria McVeigh. Remember, as you go about your weekend, to be gentle with your neighbor.